you've got the Oklahoma-Georgia game, Ivan, that was up and down the field. I mean, it's offensive football at its finest. Clemson-Alabama was not as entertaining, but just dominant physical defense by Alabama. And then this game, with as unlikely an ending, with a true freshman quarterback throwing the winning touchdown pass to a true freshman receiver. Two teams from the same conference, mentor, understudy. I think it's everything and then some, what we'd hoped for when we went down the playoff road.
These last three seasons have separated Saban from just so many other coaches.
Duke's the most talented team in the country. They start five NBA pros. Four of them are freshmen, but they're not good defensively. I think it's Michigan State and Villanova is the two best teams, but right. They're not alone as teams that can win it. I think they're the most mature. They've got star power, like Villanova's got Jalen Brunson and Mikal Bridges, and then Michigan State has the best depth. They don't take a dip when they go to their bench. They got 10 guys that can play. Most of them are sophomores. They're in the top five in offensive efficiency and defensive efficiency. They're the only team in the country that's ranked that way.
When it comes to football, coaching matters the most of any sport in this country. As great as Tom Brady is, and to me, he's the greatest quarterback ever, give me the great coach. Coach Belichick was grooming Jimmy Garoppolo and could have done some great things in New England with Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback. He's done things with Matt Castle, you know, went 11-5 with Matt Castle. And I think most people would agree that Jimmy Garoppolo is a better quarterback than Matt Castle. So give me the great coach over the great quarterback.
LeVar Ball is going to be LeVar Ball. No matter what, he's not going to change because he's one of a kind. I mean, he's that father that just doesn't care in this day and age when everybody else is worried what to say and how to say it. He'll go on the record when other people won't, taking shots at Luke Walton, his son's coach, when he wants his two other sons, LiAngelo and LaMelo, to play for the Lakers is something that just shocks me and I think a lot of other people. And no, LeVar Ball is not going to change. He's not.
I think it's one of those things that the NBA should step in and suspend, and I mean lengthy suspension, because in my mind, it's a straight-up 80s pro wrestling clothesline. When guy runs at you, it sticks out the arm and just knocks you flat on your butt. And I don't care if he went to try and help him up afterwards. It was a cheap move. It was a cheap shot, and he should be absolutely sat down by the league. They have to send a message at this point, because if it was Boogie, whoo!
So we've lost five straight on the road, and all of them have been horrendous defensive efforts, every one of them. Dallas, Orlando, Miami, Philly, and tonight, pathetic defensive efforts. I don't think our effort's even close to good. Miami game, we made a little bit of an effort. We just got broken down off the dribble too much. But the other four games, we haven't made an effort. We've started the game with no defensive disposition. I mean, I admire the resolve hanging in the game tonight, but at the end of the day, we didn't deserve to win with what we put out there tonight.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Is anybody going to call for the job of Stan Van Gundy anytime soon? I just have to ask that question. In the wake of the Jim Caldwell firing for being average, and average isn't good enough, in the wake of the Jim Caldwell firing for being above 500, not very far above it, but above 500 at 36-28, but really the coach of an average team, a team that was terrible when he took it over, made average by him, and now they're looking for somebody else to lift it above average into championship contender. That's what happened to Jim Caldwell. Is anybody going to start holding Stan Van Gundy accountable in the very same way? That wasn't how I planned on starting this show, to be honest with you. We are going to talk about a lot of coaching in this show. John Gruden introduced yesterday by the Oakland Raiders as their new head coach. What was once old is new again. It's a great hire. I know John Gruden. I'm very fond of John Gruden. I think he's going to be a phenomenal, phenomenal fit back there with the team that he helped build back in the first part of this millennium. But I heard that little clip there at the end from Stan Van Gundy talking about the loss, and I'm looking at they've lost three of their last four again. They're in another one of their funks, and I'm looking just up and down at the recent record, loss, win, loss, loss, win, loss, win, win, loss, win, 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 loss, 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 loss. They had the seven-game losing streak. Win, win, loss. I mean, They're just such an average. They're 28-1-18, a couple games over 500. They're very, very average. Is that good enough? Is that where we are now in Pistons world? David Fernandez and I will talk about this at about 4:10. But I'm just kind of wondering exactly what the goal for the Pistons, you know, long-term is. Is just being an average basketball team enough? Is everybody happy with this? Is this okay? You know, Stan is out there being loud and obnoxious and annoying the way he is. He's joining Rick Carlisle and ripping ESPN for quoting LeVar Ball on Luke Walton. He's into that. You know, and it's fine, whatever. And he's a good quote, no doubt about that. He is a good quote. He is somebody that, you know, kind of keeps your team in the spotlight, if you will, a little bit anyway. But is Stan Van Gundy's record good enough for him to just kind of have carte blanche as being he's an untouchable? At what point is somebody going to question his coaching record, particularly, you know, in these last couple of seasons with the Detroit Pistons? He's supposed to turn this thing around and make them more than just an average team. He's supposed to be lifting this team to a championship level, right? He came to the Pistons in what, Jim? 3 years ago, 2014?
Yeah.
2014, 2015?
Yeah.
32 and 50, fifth in the division, really bad. Turned it around, got about 500, won 44 games in 2015-2016, lost in the first round of the playoffs. Last year took a step back to pretty terrible again at 37 and 45, missed the playoffs again. Hold on, let me pull out my trusty little smartphone here, which, of course, contains the calculator that so many of us use when you can't add off the top of your head as well as we would like. By my count, that's 32 plus 44 plus 37 wins plus 21 this season. That's 134 against, let's see, I can do the losses in my head maybe. 50 and 45 is 95, and 30 is 125, and 8 is 133, and 18 more this season. 133 and 18 is what, 151? So 134 and 151, am I right about that now in 3.5 years?
Yeah.
134 and 151. When's the last time you heard anybody questioning Stan Van Gundy's job status? I ask that rhetorically, but also seriously. I don't know. He's the head coach. He's the president of basketball operations. He's supposed to take the Detroit Bad Boys to being Detroit Bad Boys again. That doesn't mean getting, you know, 15 personal fouls and 5 flagrants a night the way that the Rick Mahorn, Bill Laimbeer, Dennis Rodman Bad Boys were, but you understand my point. He's supposed to restore the Pistons to you know, basketball greatness. A team that can put pressure on the Celtics, that can put pressure on the Wizards, the Raptors, and, of course, the 3-time conference champion Cavaliers. Yes, they don't have LeBron or... Technically, no, they don't have LeBron. Understood. I'm not saying he's supposed to be the best team, you know, have the best team in the league or the best team in the conference, but is 134 and 151 being a few games under 500 in 3.5 years? Is this when? Just curious. If you're a Pistons fan, are you okay? Or do you feel like this team is on the come? This team is on its way to being, you know, the championship caliber team that'll excite us every night at Little Caesars, that'll get us, you know, fired up for the playoffs. Do you feel like, man, we are just really, really set up for the future, set up for the present and for the immediate future? We're ready to go, baby. Because Stan's got this thing as well, or a machine, or are they just treading water? I feel like the Pistons are stuck in a snowdrift, and they're spinning their tires, and ain't getting nowhere. And Stan is out there trying to find a 2x4, something to put underneath the back tires and get some traction, and he doesn't have it. And it's a goofy metaphor, especially now that it's going to be in the 50s tomorrow. But you understand my point, since it is wintertime. I figured I'd run with that one. Stan Van Gundy is underachieving, in my estimation, as a coach. He's underachieving. In his career, He's, you know, got a pretty good number, 484 and 341, counting his time in Miami and Orlando. You have 359 win seasons to your credit. That's pretty doggone good. A couple of 52 win seasons as well. All right. You know, clearly he has a pedigree in this league. But in Detroit, not so much. 151 and 100, or excuse me, 134 and 151. When's somebody going to say, hey, this isn't good. This is below good. This is below average. It's below 500. If 500 is average, you're below average. You're the basketball ops guy. You're the head coach. You get to shop for the groceries and cook the meal anyway. I don't know, Kush. Am I being a little too harsh here? You know what's bringing this up strangely and ironically is the interview that I did with, what in the heck was his name? Jeff Haynes or something? Haynes?
Joseph Haynes from last week.
Joseph Haynes.
Yeah.
Thank you. He's the one who wrote the article about Jim Caldwell being on the hot seat in Detroit because of racism. And if you didn't hear that, you know, what day did we have that on, Jim?
That was
last Wednesday, maybe.
Yeah, that was last Wednesday.
We could go today.
Yeah, we could go today. It's on. You should be able to find it. Anybody who's looking for it on our website under the podcast tab at 1065theticket.com.
That's the reason I was asking when it was, because if you didn't hear that interview, you really should. You really, really should. If you've got time and you're in front of a keyboard or your phone or whatever, go to our podcast page at 1065theticket.com. And listen to last Wednesday's, second hour? It was 4:10, I think?
Yeah, maybe? Second hour.
Yeah, listen to last Wednesday's show. Anyway, Joseph Haynes tried to say that Jim Caldwell was on the hot seat and eventually got fired because of racism, and fans and media in Detroit didn't like him because he was a black coach, for whatever reason. I thought that was one of the most ignorant takes that I've heard in a long time, and I wanted to talk to him about it, and we did. But in his article in which he made that assertion, he did say, when's the last time anybody called for Stan Van Gundy's job? Look at his record. And I wanted to say at the time, well, people have, at least I have, last year.
We've done it at
saying,
periods,
you know,
of time
real...
on this show when they've struggled. Yes, we have.
Yeah.
At least we have.
Bingo. We have. Now, we're not Detroit media. So maybe he's speaking about Detroit media and Detroit fans, because that's who he said was essentially misjudging or being too harsh on Jim Caldwell because of his race. He said it was Detroit media and Detroit fans, which is very strange given the racial demographic, by the way, in Detroit. But be that as it may, he said, what about Stan? And I remember thinking to myself, I know I've talked about it somewhat, at least in passing last year as they took a big step back. Because you remember, Jim, going into last season, coming off of the playoff season, which they were rolled then by the Cavaliers in the first round. It's weird. They got swept in the first round in 2016. And yet it was a very competitive series because all four games, I don't think any were blowouts, if memory serves.
No, basically none of them were. It's as close as a sweep can be in its games.
Right, like that. For a one versus, especially in a one versus eight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, so. And last year you predicted a step forward from, you know, 44 victories to maybe pushing up toward 50 victories, and instead of being a seed, maybe getting up in around the fifth or fourth seed, possibly even being a home court advantage.
I certainly did. That blew up in my face.
Well, but I don't say that to blow that up, because I didn't disagree. I don't know if I necessarily said, yeah, me too, but I was perfectly comfortable with your reasoning and your logic behind that prediction. And when it didn't come to pass, when they collapsed and took a giant step backwards, and you can say injuries happened, of course, and you know, Reggie Jackson, all this other stuff, that's fine. But I remember at several points last year saying, you know, at what point does Stan have to start answering some questions about the big picture here and about the future and about the direction of this team? Are they making advancements toward championship level, or are they just kind of spinning and running in place? And that was about the only one, because for this job, you know, even though we're not in the sports, Detroit sports media, we read it, we study it, we pay attention to what they're saying up there, we look at what fans have to say in Detroit, and of course just Detroit fans in Northwest Ohio, but I didn't see it anywhere else, which is why I'm asking this question now. Why is everybody just okay with Stan Van Gundy's explanation of another loss or another run of three losses in four games, whatever it is, where he's such a great quote and he sounds so, I'm going to hold my players accountable for this. We didn't get it done this way, that way. And he sounds like, you know, he sounds authoritative. And maybe that's how he gets by. He sounds authoritative. He sounds like he's on top of the problem. He sounds like this is all it was and we can fix that. It's like, okay, well, as long as we know. As long as he's not in there shrugging his shoulders at post-game press conferences going, I don't know why we can't win. I don't know what's going on. As long as he sounds authoritative and like he has the problem, I can pinpoint it, and that's what we'll work on, and that's what we'll get better, and it sends everybody home going, okay, well, as long as we know that they know what's wrong. And it's like with your kid, you know? It's not just that you lost your whatever. I want you to know how you did that. What was your mindset before that? Do you realize what was irresponsible about what led to that outcome? As long as you know what you did wrong, we'll deal with the fact that you did it wrong, and that's okay. And that's how it is with Stan Van Gundy. He stands up there authoritatively. We did play the clip again. Play the little just the post game clip that you had from the Pistons loss to the Pelicans, 112-109. This being, again, their third loss in four games, losing to the Heat by seven, then a blowout, the worst of the season by the 76ers. Then they beat the Rockets, sans James Harden, and then a loss to the Pelicans. Give me that Stan Van one more time, Jim Cushman.
So we've lost five straight on the road, and all of them have been horrendous defensive efforts. Every one of them. Dallas, Orlando, Miami, Philly, and tonight. Pathetic defensive efforts. I don't think our effort's even close to good. Miami game, we made a little bit of an effort. We just got broken down off the dribble too much. But the other four games, we haven't made an effort. We've started the game with no defensive disposition. I mean, I admire the resolve hanging in the game tonight, but at the end of the day, we didn't deserve to win with what we put out there tonight.
So, you know, it's like, I know what it is. It's defensive effort, and we'll get the guys to give defensive effort, and then we're okay. And it's, we didn't deserve to win. So it's the take the loss on yourself, and nobody can keep criticizing you, right? You know, when you actually own it, when you say, you know what, we didn't deserve to win. We didn't deserve to win those games. And the fans are like, damn right you did, and that was terrible. But, you know, at least as long as you know it, then we're okay with that. I think he's got a really masterful way of playing the media, because I think the media and the fans should be just a little bit more upset than they are about where they are in year four of the Stan Van Gundy project, known as building the Pistons back into a championship team. And I don't feel like they're any closer to being a conference contender, let alone a championship contender, but a conference contender, Kush, in year four of this process than they were in year one. And in year one or in year two when they made the playoffs. I feel like this is just a whole bunch of spinning their wheels. And fortunately, I'm a Cavaliers fan, so, you know, there's no sweat off my nose. But I will tell you, I feel for Pistons fans who might be listening right now and kind of wondering what the hell's going on.
You know, and when I think of this, too, there's also the other aspect.
And hold on, maybe ask the question. I said I feel for Pistons fans who are wondering what the hell's going on. Let me ask this. If you're a Pistons fan, are you wondering what the hell's going on? Do you feel like this is unacceptable and I'm tired of this status quo and I'm tired of the, kind of running in place where we are? We're not making progress, because I haven't heard a whole hell of a lot of noise coming from Pistons fans. Again, maybe not because I'm not sitting up in Detroit right now, but I haven't heard them barking, and I'm wondering why they're not barking. Go ahead, Jay.
No, and part of the problem is the kind of stuck in the mud since that playoff year, two seasons ago, you know, the missing last year, playing a little bit better to be in the thick of at least making the playoffs again, but they're essentially now a year behind where they should be because of their step back a year ago. And as for questioning, you know, how much longer you want somebody like Stan Van as the coach, we also can't forget the other aspect here is his front office position, the dual positions that he has. Do you get rid of him from both positions?
Well, yeah,
just
my
one
point.
Of them.
That was the point that I made. You're the coach and the basketball
right.
ops director. That means you shop for the groceries and you cook the meal.
Exactly.
You're 100% responsible for the status of the franchise and the performance and the win-loss record. You're not just a coach where you can say, hey, like Hugh Jackson, well, my front office didn't get me enough players. And you're not a front office guy saying, I got great players, but the coach can't coach them. You're both. You own both titles. You're 100% responsible for the direction of the club.
Exactly.
And if your club is spinning its wheels in that space, like I said, you know, stuck in the mud or in the snow or whatever, then it is 100% on you. And yes, in my estimation, if and when the time comes to make changes, it would be for both positions. You're hiring a new front office guy/GM, and you're letting him hire his own coach.
No, and that's fair because, you know, depending on who you'd ask when a guy is in those types of positions, you know, that might vary depending who you're talking to. I mean, look at the Clippers. You know, Doc Rivers was in both spots for a while, and if I'm not mistaken, he's now just head coach, right? Out there in L.A. with the struggling Clippers, but they kept him on, you know, as the coach. And that's, to me, what I'd wonder in that situation, and I think you'd get varying answers depending on who you're talking to, if he should be removed from one of the positions or both altogether. But I think you really, really, and we've brought it up a few times, as we mentioned here on this show, especially in the last couple seasons when they've struggled. Yeah, if they don't at least make the playoffs and probably somehow get out of round one, if they really can finish in that 4, 5, 6 kind of area, then you really, this summer, have to start answering those questions. And lastly, you said you wanted some Pistons fans to think about this. You want to take one right now?
Yeah, we can do that. In fact, I was going to do that next. And I'm not telling them. I'm asking, really. I'm not saying you should be mad. You should be calling for Stan Van Gundy's head.
I'm not there yet. If they fall on their face as the season goes along, then I might get there.
Well, let's put it to you this way. If they finish 3 games over .500 the way they are right now, I would not be satisfied with that.
I agree with that. I really wouldn't be.
Because chances are they're either going to be in the A spot again or they're not going to be in the playoffs at all. And I just don't think that'd be satisfied. So, again, I'm not telling anybody what to do or how to feel. If you're a Pistons fan, I'm just curious at what. And, again, this was prompted by the Jim Caldwell. Jim Caldwell got fired for being 38-26, which is average. He's average. He took a team that was below average and made it average, and that was good enough for the first couple of years. But in the last two of the four years, he didn't advance from average to above average and toward a championship. So they said, okay, we got Stan Van Gundy. Is below average. He's below average. He's 134 to 151 in 3.5 seasons now, and I feel like there might be time for Pistons fans to at least ask the question, is this all we're going to get? Is this all we're going to get on our plate right now? Because I'm a little hungrier than 134 to 151. Gabe is in Toledo. Wants to talk about just that. Gabe, thanks for waiting for us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Go right ahead.
Like, long-time listener, I remember I called in about 2 years ago saying that it wasn't Jim Caldwell's fault, and it was, like, the president and the general manager and everything, and they got axed, and they kept Jim.
Yeah.
Really kind of sad to see him go, because I do think, for me, as a Detroit fan, I want to see improvement, like, just consistent improvement, and you look at the players and the player development and everything, and players are getting better, but the team's not. And that's what it feels like to me. So
So let me make sure I understand that. Because you said you're sad to see him go, but then you just admitted the team wasn't getting any better. So do you think it was the right decision to let him go or no?
I mistakenly jumped back to the Pistons. I think the Lions should have kept him.
You did. Okay.
If we're speaking about the Lions, I really like him. I think just the division was so good this year. And it's not, you don't want to make excuses, but it's one of those things, like, coaches are going to have some situations stacked against them. I feel like that's what this year was. So next year could have been that breakout year because you finally got a lot of people.
I know you called to talk about the Pistons, but since you got me on this now, you really think the division was that good this year with Green Bay losing Rodgers, Chicago starting a rookie quarterback and being at the cellar? I know Minnesota, of course, got really good, even despite Case Keenum having to be their quarterback. But I don't know that this was such a, quote, good division this year that it was too much for Caldwell to ask for him to compete for this division championship. I kind of feel like the Ducks were lined up pretty good. You don't have to deal with the Packers at full strength, minus Aaron Rodgers. You don't have to deal with the Bears. You do have the Vikings, but I kind of feel... I don't know. I look at the NFC South and I say that was a really good division. 3-10 win plus teams, 3 playoff teams in the Saints and the Falcons and the Panthers. I don't know that I saw the NFC North as being too good for the Lions to take a big step forward this year. What makes you think it was so good?
I don't know. Games I watched. Yeah, all the games, which I didn't watch as many as I should have. But I don't know. It was one of those things, like, that you always say the players never quit, and everybody's going. They didn't seem too blown out. Some of them, they did look outmatched, but those were the games you kind of expected.
The ones they looked outmatched, and this to me is probably what sealed Jim Caldwell's fate. And by the way, I agree with you and disagree with you. I disagree with that they should have kept him, but I agree with you and that I feel bad that he's gone because I like him. I like him as a person. I like his demeanor. I like his control, and I like the fact that he did build this team from really trash prior to his arrival to something that is at least competitive. But this is probably what sealed his fate. His record against teams that were playoff teams or teams that were winning records versus the scrubs. He was successful in getting wins against the scrubs, and against the playoff caliber teams, they could not compete. And to me, that is a preparation thing as much as anything else. You look at the, you know, that run of the season after starting out 2-0, they played Falcons, playoff team loss. They played Carolina, playoff team loss. They played New Orleans, playoff team loss. Played Pittsburgh, playoff team loss. Then played Green Bay, non-playoff team win. Then played Cleveland, non-playoff team win. You see my point? I could go on and on like that. That was the probably what sealed the fate is, hey, we're okay when we're playing teams that aren't very good, but if we want to win a championship, we have to, and a division championship alone, we have to beat those playoff caliber teams. And right now in year four of the Caldwell plan, it's just not happening, and I feel like that's probably what sealed his fate. But anyway, getting back to Stan Van, your thoughts on you know whether or not this is similar in spinning the wheels or you're headed in the right direction and you're comfortable leaving him alone?
I'm comfortable lessening his role to either like president, player personnel, or coach. I know you kind of mentioned that. They're not getting out developed, if that makes sense. Like Andre Drummond, I remember. Got kind of booted out of the playoffs because the guy couldn't shoot free throws. This year, that's a non-issue, not only because of the rule change, but also not
because
now the guy
Andre
can shoot.
Drummond's work ethic. Like he fixed his problem, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. And I remember when we brought Reggie Jackson over, everybody was freaking out about Reggie Jackson. Kind of mishandled him last year. I don't know what was going on with that. And I think he said he didn't know what was going on with that. How he kind of fumbled holding him out and benching him and whatever all that was. But I don't think anybody saw Reggie Jackson being what Reggie Jackson is now when he brought him over and started working with him. So he makes good decisions, and it's just really hard because a lot of respect for the Cavaliers. You have to. And, you know, you get swept in four games. You're trying to sit there and say, like, oh, well, you know, it's the Cavs, you know, they're going to go to the finals, no big deal. But it's also like, we could have won a game, at least a game. And
well, and most importantly, even if you are going to get swept and you don't win a game in that series, you go back next year and make it better. And in fact, the next year they were worse and, of course, never made it to the playoffs last year. So that's the thing. And now this year, again, it's just very, very similar. And, you know, sitting there at a couple of games over 500, and I just don't know what's going. So you're not a fan of getting rid of Stan altogether, but reducing his role, as Jim just talked about, the way they did with Doc Rivers in Clipperland. They gave him took away his GM duties, and he's just the coach. So you would, if you were to take away one or the other with Stan, would you keep him as the coach and just get a GM to run the show, or would you let him run the basketball ops and bring another coach in?
I think that'd be whatever he'd be more willing to do, because
okay.
I think they waited too long with Doc Rivers to separate his duties. And it's not that Stan isn't doing enough on both ends. I just think he's trying to do too much. And one's watering the other down.
So you'd let him pick. You can do one or the other, but not both of them. And that's fair.
Yeah,
to me, I guess that really depends on you know, how much you value his ability to do just one. Because in my mind, I feel like if you gave him the full control of this thing and it just hasn't worked, I almost feel like I want to just start over. I want to hire a GM who gets to pick his own coach, who isn't going to be stuck, well, not stuck, but saddled with, you know, the holdover coach that is Stan Van Gundy. I always believe that a GM should be able, if his job is going to be on the line based on wins and losses, he ought to be able to hire his own coach. That's football, baseball, doesn't matter, any of basketball. That's every sport to me. Hey, Gabe, I got to run, brother. I appreciate the phone call, but I'm running a little bit late here for the Bottom of the Hour Sports Center, which is coming your way after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Think Trae Young would look good in a Pistons uniform? I think he'd look good in just about any NBA uniform. Trae Young of Oklahoma, the nation's best player, the nation's most dynamic scorer, and just player all around. Trae Young of Oklahoma continuing. Last night in the Sooners' win over Texas Tech, he had 27 points, making it the 13th straight game where he scored at least 25 points. And if you're wondering where that ranks historically, well, that 13 straight games of 25 or more is the most in the last 20 years of college basketball. Last time somebody even had 12 straight games of 25 or more, it was Troy Bell of Boston College back in 2002-2003. So Trae Young of Oklahoma getting it done, and that is your Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. All right, it's 3:38. We'll get the bottom of the hour. Local Sports Center coming your way. We'll come back, take more of your phone calls. Coming up at 4:10, we'll dive more into the Pistons and talk about Stan Van Gundy and where the Pistons are in the big picture, the grand scheme of things, if you will. David Fernandez, of course, is with DetroitBadBoys.com. That's coming up later right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Back indeed, rolling onward. It's 3:46. Coming up at about 4:10, we are going to be talking to David Fernandez, who writes about the Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com. We'll talk a little bit more about Stan Van Gundy and the direction the boys up in the Motor City. If Nick Saban is to win a seventh national championship, he's going to have to replace some pretty important guys. Calvin Ridley declared for the draft today. He is the All-American wide receiver. Caught one of the big touchdown passes, the second-to-last touchdown pass thrown by two of the true freshmen. A play that maybe was not intended for him. We all remember that. But All-American wide receiver, as well as that Damian Harris. That's another one. Damian Harris is on his way to the National Football League as well, the top running back that they had as well. So a couple of – but you know what? You saw what he does, and this is, of course, what makes him so good. I want to talk more, by the way, about Nick Saban's ability or willingness to put trust in young players and kind of compare that to the guy up in Michigan who's supposed to be closing the gap between himself and Urban Meyer and himself – and Nick Saban. Remember, this is, I mean, I'd have to think about this, and I'm probably not in the position to do it because this is really just kind of off the cuff. But, Kush, if I were to say ask the average college football fan to name the three top coaches or three most recognizable college football coaches, who do you think they would say?
They probably say, in no particular order, Saban, Urban, and Harbaugh.
That's kind of where I was going with it. I might be wrong, by the way. Somebody out west might say, you know, Chip Kelly. And somebody might say, I don't know, blah, 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 blah. Pick somebody else. There's other big names. And I mean, you know, James Franklin at Penn State, he probably still doesn't have that name recognition. I don't know that anybody has, like, the great, amazing – they might say Lane Kiffin is recognizable, but for different reasons.
Right. I was just going to say he's number four on my list just because of all the old stuff before Florida Atlantic.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's, you know, for different reasons. And part of the reason is those three guys are three of, if not the three, highest-paid coaches in college football. You know, it's Harbaugh, number one. He's the richest coach in college. And it's Saban and it's Urban Meyer. And we talked about the absurdity of that, of course, after Harbaugh lost to Urban Meyer again, his third straight time now. And we talked about the absurdity of it. And we should talk about the absurdity of it, that he makes any more money. And, in fact, he shouldn't make half of the money that Nick Saban is making, based solely on results. Now you say, well, Saban's been there a lot longer and he didn't start winning all his national championships until he was in Alabama for a while. And okay, that's fine. But Nick Saban, he has taken college football and Belichicked it. And what I mean by that is there's not a question. If you were to ask the same group of people you asked who the top three college coaches, or excuse me, pro coaches were in the NFL, Jim, what do you think they would say?
At the NFL level?
Yeah.
They would certainly say Belichick.
And then they'd probably stop talking.
They might, yeah. I mean, I think depending on where you are, maybe Pete Carroll's name comes up in Seattle. I'm just spitballing what I know, but I'm not saying it's right.
I don't think there is a definitive second and third because Belichick has put such a distance between himself and everybody else. That's Belichicking the NFL. I feel like Nick Saban has Belichicked college football. The distance between himself and even Urban Meyer. Is so vast with his 6 championships now and 5 since 2009. It's just so huge, that gap, that the second two don't even really matter, and yet Jim Harbaugh makes more money than that guy and isn't getting even close to the results. It's not like Harbaugh won the Big Ten in his second year, went into the playoffs and lost to Nick Saban, where it's like, hey, it's a battle, but boy, he's coming for him. You know, it's gotten worse, particularly from last year to this year, all the way down to a very, very embarrassing 8-5. You know, an 8-4 and a strong fourth-place finish in the Big Ten East. Woo! You know, I tell you what, the Wolverine Roar is coming back. Maize and blue, baby, get ready. Fourth place in the Big Ten East. And, oh, by the way, then losing the bowl game with a 19-3 lead in the second half. What's going on? And so I've been trying to figure that out. And I just, you know, started pondering it on Monday's show, as you recall, Tuesday's show, beg your pardon, after watching the Monday night national championship game. And I just wonder how much of Nick Saban's willingness to be new school, despite being an old guy. What is Saban? He's got to be pushing up on 70, isn't he? Or on 68 years old, something like that, I'm going to guess.
Good call. Let me check.
I'm totally guessing on that, but I just feel like as he's been around for so long, I feel like he's got to be up in that.
He's 66.
66. All right. I was close. I'll take that. Nick Saban is more new school despite being older. He is willing to forego the old tried and true method of taking young five-star recruits, redshirting them, seasoning them, grooming them, waiting for the guy in front of them to graduate, and then getting them in their sophomore or junior years and that sort of thing. And he's taking freshmen, and he's putting them in all over the field. He trusts them. You know, the coach at Georgia, Kirby Smart, did the same thing with a freshman quarterback. And I just wonder, and I'm not saying that will be the be-all, end-all to make Jim Harbaugh better, but I just wonder if, you know, it isn't time to just stop trusting the older, seasoned guys, the O'Corns of the world that we're talking about, and just put the trust in the guys you recruited. You recruited them to come and play. Not to be clipboard holders and, you know, red shirts and so on and so forth and practice players. You recruited them to come and play and make that happen. And I don't know. Maybe it's easier for Nick Saban because, as I said yesterday to the commissioner when we spoke with Bill Conley yesterday, Nick Saban's recruiting has just, you know, been taken care of by itself, for itself, for a long, long time. He doesn't have to go out and get people. He just screens people. Everybody in the country who's a five-star Under Armour All-American wants to come to Alabama. He screens and says, okay, you can come, you can come, and you can come, and you come. And so maybe when they're that good, the freshmen are ready to go, and maybe at Michigan, at this stage of the process, if you want to use that term, maybe at Michigan, at this stage of Jim Harbaugh's process, he just his you know, freshmen aren't as good as that. They're not ready to compete. They're not ready to help win right now. They're better off learning in a redshirt type of environment. But all I know is Jim Harbaugh has done this now. He had Jake Rudock, right, his first year,
right,
who was a transfer in, fifth-year graduate transfer from Iowa. Then he went to Wilton-Spate last year, you know, the season previous to this one that just
right, ended. 2016 season.
Right, right, right. And then Spate got hurt, so he went back to the fifth-year senior transfer, John O'Corn. And now, you know, despite having a Dylan McCaffrey waiting in the wings, Brandon Peters did not look good in the bowl game, but you certainly don't sum up a guy's ceiling based on one bowl game. But you know, you have young guns there who are 4- and 5-star recruits. You got Joe Milton, a true freshman, 4-star quarterback coming in. And what is Jim Harbaugh doing? I need me somebody who's already done it. I don't want to have to develop and groom a freshman or a redshirt freshman quarterback. Give me Shea Patterson. And Patterson is coming in from Mississippi, and he's already played a full season. And so, you know, it's that same kind of mentality. I don't trust the young ones I'm recruiting. I'm going to trust the ones that somebody else recruited and already coached up a little bit and already have a leg up, and I just got to kind of, you know, push them forward. And I wonder if that's what's holding Harbaugh back. Because I'll tell you this, if I'm a Michigan fan, it's kind of like what I said with, you know, with Detroit. I don't want to speak for anybody and tell you how to feel. But if I'm a Michigan fan, the cartwheels that I was doing when Jim Harbaugh was finally named head coach of his alma mater ended a while back, and now I am literally going to lead the charge, if I'm a Michigan fan, to push for a new, I don't know if I want to go out on a limb and say a new coach, but push for a new regime in charge of Michigan football. If he doesn't come away with wins against Ohio State, which is a mandatory, he must end that drought this coming football season. And against one or the other, if not all, you know, both of them are talking about Michigan State and Penn State. He's 2-7 against them. He's 1-5 against the two biggest rivalries, which are Ohio State and Michigan State. Little brother is now big brother. Jim Harbaugh was supposed to come back to Michigan and put little brother in his place. He hasn't done it. If he doesn't win 2 out of 3 against those two teams, and one of them must be Ohio State and qualify for the Big Ten championship game, I think it's time to push for a new regime in Michigan football. If that means a new head coach, then it means a new head coach. I guess that'll be up to whoever is in charge of the whole thing. But from the athletic director to the board of directors to everybody, the board of trustees and everybody who makes these decisions, because if Jim Harbaugh can't do it, then God is only wondering, you know, who possibly can. And if he doesn't do it in year 4, and if we have more of this just, you know,
8-4 losing to the
back,
yeah, or
you know, that kind of thing, because that's what it was. One step forward when he first got there, 2 steps back. You have any more of that, honestly, you're gonna find yourself back into Brady Hoke territory, and I don't think that's what anybody.
We're in agreement that now coming into year 4, the excitement flavor of the whole thing has very much worn off, and another 8-4 type season with an 0-3 against Penn State, Michigan State, and Ohio State has to be viewed as completely unacceptable. And at the barest of minimums, the questions have to start being asked, if not more, as you suggest.
Yeah, you know what else wore off, Jim, is the novelty and the goofiness of the, you know, and by the way, we spent a day and, playing over and over again the rap video of Who's Got It Better Than Us, Nobody, with Harbaugh. We just freaking loved it, you know, making fun of his own khaki pants and all 9 yards. The sleeping over at the kicker's house, taking his team to Florida, and then taking him to Rome. And
the Ric Flair being there in prison at one of the early.
All of that fun stuff is worn off when you're not winning. If he's winning at Urban Meyer's level, let alone at Nick Saban's level,
we'd have to play that on repeat the whole day.
All of that is just the pure joy. Everybody loves it. But if you're not winning, you know what it is? It's gimmickry. It's gimmickry. You can't fool kids that you're trying to recruit with all of these gimmicks. If they see you doing all of this silly stuff and you're winning, they're right with you and they're laughing and saying, I can't wait to play for that guy. But if you're pulling all of these antics and you're going 8-5 and you're losing in bowl games to teams you should beat when you're up 19-3 and all of these kinds of things, it's like, man, I ain't going up there to be a part of that circus. That dude's just whack. That dude's crazy. No, I'm not doing that. That's the problem, as far as I can see it, for Jim Harbaugh. And by the way, it's kind of interesting that we're talking about this because there's a pretty good article on Sports Illustrated underscoring this. It was written about a week ago about the offseason of pressure and uncertainty for Jim Harbaugh. I don't think he's under pressure in terms of for his job. I've said this before. I don't think he is in danger of being fired. I don't think that Michigan's leadership would be willing to pull that trigger because, quite obviously, again, who is going to do better at somebody, you know, better at this than a Michigan man, if we go back to Bo's old language? That is Jim Harbaugh. But I think the pressure is on for his reputation and his stock. If he ever has designs on going back to the NFL, and hopefully if he's successful at Michigan, that doesn't happen for 10, 15 years. He's young. Youngish. Youngish. If he ever has designs on keeping that reputation he had as being a winner everywhere he's been, and that's what makes him attractive and desirable, then he's got to get that going right now. His reputation is on the line this particular coming season. There's a pretty good piece at ESPN.com talking about the offseason pressure that he is truly going to be under. Let me get Jimmy in Toledo on the air real quick, even though I know we got top of the hour Sports Center coming our way. David Fernandez of the DetroitBadBoys.com SB Nation site waiting on the other side as well. But Jimmy, go ahead and give me your thoughts on Harbaugh.
Well, it's different for Saban and Harbaugh. Here's why. Saban can make things happen because he's got control. He can do whatever the heck he wants, and he's won so much that despite whatever happens, nobody can really second-guess him at this point. He's got all the control, and his experience in the NFL has led him to know that, hey, listen, at the college level, I have all the control, and that's why I wasn't a success in Miami because I had somebody telling me I had to take Dante Culpepper instead of Drew Brees, right?
That's true.
He doesn't have that problem in college. He gets whoever he wants. He can do whatever he wants, and he can put whoever he wants in the game at any time. And Harbaugh, he found out in the pros that ain't, you know, that isn't always the case. If he can wear somebody, you know, the wrong way and or have a weird owner, have a personality tick, and he's out the door, okay? So at Michigan, he might be under pressure now, and I've lost a lot of watching that South Carolina game and watching them hand off to a tight end. I've lost a lot of my I'm not doing cartwheels for him either, even though I'm an Ohio State fan. But I think they're nuts, even if he loses to all the rivals next year. They'd be nuts to fire him, and here's why. They're starting to get in the Lions territory where they're just starting to fire everybody every 4 years. And at some point, it's like, look, Jim Harbaugh is a smart football coach. He knows how to coach. And at some point, those quarterbacks are regressing because they're afraid of getting hit. And until they solve their offensive line woes, this kind of offense just isn't going to work because unless you protect
the
quarterback.
That's the most perplexing thing about it, Jimmy. That's the most perplexing thing because what is – and thanks for the call. I got to hit it here.
Yep.
But that what has Michigan been known for more than great offensive linemen? I mean, that's been a big, big part of the Michigan tradition and the Michigan history. And you're right. You're right. That has to be fixed. But he does need to settle on a quarterback, preferably a young one that he has recruited, and actually buy in and invest in him rather than looking for these fifth-year or transfer ins and that sort of thing. But you're right. It does start and end up front, and he needs to make sure that his classes reflect that, his recruiting classes reflect that. All right, it is 4-2. Had to cut Jimmy short. Apologies for that, but got to get out for our top of the hour Sports Center because coming up, we'll talk more hoops with David Fernandez right here on The Ticket.
You've got the Oklahoma-Georgia game, Ivan, that was up and down the field. I mean, it's offensive football at its finest. Clemson-Alabama was not as entertaining, but just dominant physical defense by Alabama. And then this game, with as unlikely an ending, with a true freshman quarterback throwing the winning touchdown pass to a true freshman receiver. Two teams from the same conference, mentor, understudy. I think it's everything and then some, what we hoped for when we went down the playoff road.
These last three seasons have separated Saban from just so many other coaches.
Duke's the most talented team in the country. They start five NBA pros. Four of them are freshmen, but they're not good defensively. I think it's Michigan State and Villanova is the two best teams, but
right. They're
not alone as teams that can win it. I think they're the most mature. They've got star power. Like Villanova's got Jalen Brunson and Mikal Bridges, and then Michigan State has the best depth. They don't take a dip when they go to their bench. They got 10 guys that can play. Most of them are sophomores. They're in the top five in offensive efficiency and defensive efficiency. They're the only team in the country that's ranked that way.
When it comes to football, coaching matters the most of any sport in this country. As great as Tom Brady is, and to me, he's the greatest quarterback ever, give me the great coach. Coach Belichick was grooming Jimmy Garoppolo and could have done some great things in New England with Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback. He's done things with Matt Castle, you know, went 11-5 with Matt Castle. And I think most people would agree that Jimmy Garoppolo is a better quarterback than Matt Castle. So give me the great coach over the great quarterback.
LeVar Ball is going to be LeVar Ball. No matter what, he's not going to change because he's one of a kind. I mean, he's that father that just doesn't care in this day and age when everybody else is worried what to say and how to say it. He'll go on the record when other people won't, taking shots at Luke Walton, his son's coach, when he wants his two other sons, LiAngelo and LaMelo, to play for the Lakers is something that just shocks me and I think a lot of other people. And no, LeVar Ball is not going to change. He's not.
I think it's one of those things that the NBA should step in and suspend, and I mean lengthy suspension, because in my mind, it's a straight-up 80s pro wrestling clothesline. When guy runs at you and sticks out the arm and just knocks you flat on your butt, and I don't care if he went to try and help him up afterwards, it was a cheap move, it was a cheap shot, and he should be absolutely sat down by the league. They have to send a message at this point, because if it was Boogie, whoo!
So we've lost five straight on the road, and all of them have been horrendous defensive efforts, every one of them. Dallas, Orlando, Miami, Philly, and tonight, pathetic defensive efforts. I don't think our effort's even close to good. Miami game, we made a little bit of an effort. We just got broken down off the dribble too much. But the other four games, we haven't made an effort. We started the game with no defensive disposition. I mean, I admire the resolve hanging in the game tonight, but at the end of the day, we didn't deserve to win with what we put out there tonight.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Whirling along. We are now at 13 minutes past 4 o'clock. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader, but we are focusing a lot of our attention today on some activity north of the state line. Started out the show with Stan Van Gundy, which we just kind of finished on the montage there, talking about when is it okay to start saying, you know what, being an average team isn't quite good enough for us. When is it time to start wondering if Stan Van Gundy has this team on a path to something bigger and better than 500 and making the playoffs, not making the playoffs, making the playoffs, not making the playoffs, bouncing in the first round and not making the playoffs, etc. When is it time? And then, of course, Jim Harbaugh, who continues to, and really the offseason just got started, and he's already taking a lot of heat. This is a huge offseason because it's the precursor to a huge season for Jim Harbaugh. Watching Nick Saban, who makes less money than Harbaugh does, win his sixth national championship, and watching Harbaugh continue to lose to Urban Meyer, who also earns less than Harbaugh does, is just, it's got to be a very, very bitter thing for a lot of Michigan fans. So we'll get into that a little bit more, but I want to talk back, go back on the Pistons now, and welcome David Fernandez to the show. David, of course, writes about the Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com. David, first of all, welcome to the show. Good to talk to you again. How are you?
Yeah, hey, how's it going? Happy New Year, everyone.
And to you as well, your first visit with us in 2018, first of many to come, I hope, and certainly wish you the very best as we start this new year. So, it's odd. I know there are injuries. I know Reggie Jackson being out is a factor. And I know in the game against the Pelicans, you know, they had a bunch of guys that are out. And I'm just looking at the whole big picture, not the moment where, okay, they lost a game where they have some injuries, so maybe there's some excuses for it. But, David, and I know I've talked about this with you before in much more just kind of a passing tone, but I want to address it more seriously now. Stan Van Gundy is 134 and 151 in 3.5 seasons now, or almost a half season here in 2017-18. He's 134 and 151. He made the playoffs once and was bounced in the first round in a four-game sweep, a competitive four-game sweep, as sweeps go, in an 8-versus-1 matchup, and then, of course, had the Giants step backward last year. And this year it's a 21-18, spinning our wheels, winning three or four in a row, losing three out of four, which they have done now, and it's just a very average basketball team. Nobody is going to be able to come onto the radio every day or maybe get on your website at Detroit Bad Boys and talk about how this is putrid, this is awful, Van Gundy's got to go, big changes are needed to be made. And they're not going to be coming on the radio and going on websites and saying, this is a dynamic team that's on its way to a championship run. This is being built for something special. It's just so much blah. It's just so much, so average. And listening to Stan explain away losses after a game, we didn't have defensive effort, we didn't have this, we didn't have that. Why don't you have that? Why is this continuing to be just such an up-and-down affair? And at what point do Pistons fans start to say, you know, I expect a hell of a lot more than just to, you know, a 41-win team, roughly, and a 500-type team every single season. I want better than what Stan is delivering.
I mean, I think if you look at this team and they start to really tailspin at the end of this, you know, following the All-Star break, or limping into the playoffs and getting swept again, then I think the tone will become, you know, pretty serious, not just from fans. And trust me, the fans right now are definitely disheartened and upset. And, you know, there's plenty of fire SVG tweets going on out there in Twitter land. So I think it's something where you really have to see what he's able to do as they lead up into the trade until trade deadline comes. And then, you know, what they do after that, obviously. I have some concerns myself as well with Stan Van Gundy. I think you've seen a lot of mismanagement when it comes to coaching, not only some of the moves that he's made as a GM, but some of the in-game decisions that he's made so far. So, no, I think you're right. I think if this team misses the playoffs and is it on the outside looking you get outside looking in once again, then it's going to be very hard for Tom Gores. It's going to be very hard for to kind of justify to Pistons fans bringing it back again, just because at that point the team will be in such a different type of direction. You don't even know if they're even going to bring back some of these guys. You don't know if they're going to start looking to rebuild. So, yeah, it's getting there, definitely getting there.
The reason I brought it up today is, you know, obviously the Lions, one of the, you know, one of their competitors, if you will, for the hearts and minds of Detroit sports fans is, you know, they're searching for a coach after firing a guy who was 36 and 28 in Jim Caldwell with two playoff appearances in four seasons. And again, now we're looking at Stan Van Gundy, and if he doesn't make the playoffs this year, it will be one in four seasons, and again, a sub-500 record. And I just wonder, you know, at what point Pistons fans started to settle. You know, Stan Van Gundy was given full control of the whole, you know, the whole thing, the director of basketball operations, head coach, and so nobody, you know, it's not like you can say that, hey, my GM isn't getting me good enough players, and it's not like the GM, Van Gundy, can say, my coach isn't doing it right. He's doing it all. It's what he wanted, and I feel like that accountability needs to happen. You're saying that if they tailspin, the fans will start to get really crabby about this. I'm wondering why they're not crabby now. I'm wondering why the seat isn't just a little bit warmer for a guy whose best seasons, of course, were in Orlando and a little bit in Miami when he had 359-win seasons, but he has shown nothing of the gumption to be able to make that happen in Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do have to take a little step back, though, and look at some of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, the team has underperformed in these past couple of weeks, but you can really track, you know, look back at the tracks and see that it's all going down to that Reggie Jackson injury. Now, that might say something a little bit more, you know, it might be a bigger indictment on Stan Van Gundy, the GM, since you don't have a shooting guard who can space the floor in your backup unit that would be able to be a little bit more competent with the starting unit that more than Ish Smith. But at that point, you know, after the Indiana Pacers game, the game in which Reggie Jackson went down, I believe the Pistons were six games over 500. They had won five of seven or something along that, and they were really starting to look like a team that was going to be pushing towards double digits over 500, especially with this weaker schedule that they are now in the midst of. So I do think that with that injury and everyone having an understanding that this literally wouldn't be the same record, this wouldn't be the same team if Reggie Jackson was in there, it does buy him a little time, but it's also putting a lot of pressure under him to make a move and to right this ship now, because as we've seen from Adrian Wojnarowski, the ESPN NBA reporter, the Pistons are one of the most aggressive teams right now in the trade market. And I think it is just a sign that Stan Van Gundy is looking to win. He doesn't want this team to be a two-game over 500 seventh seed going into the playoffs this upcoming season.
David Fernandez writes about the Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com. I don't care about Adrian Wojnarowski. I want to know what you think. What kinds of aggressive trades might they be looking at? What, first of all, would we be talking about more about trades to add pieces to help win or to subtract pieces at places where they're thick and maybe can be additions by subtractions? What kinds of needs do you think that Stan would be identifying here as they approach the trade deadline?
So what's come out that's been reported so far is that he's targeted Evan Fournier from the Orlando Magic, who's a shooting guard. I don't think that move makes a lot of sense because you are already pretty deep at that position. You already have.
That was the reason you acquired Avery Bradley, right? I mean, for crying out loud.
That's why you acquired
a position of strength.
Exactly. And so, you know, I don't think that – I think they would probably put him at the starting small forward. This team needs – what this team is really struggling with is a playmaker that can shoot the ball. That is what Reggie Jackson is. He's one of your best playmakers on the team, if not your best playmaker, and he can actually shoot the ball, so he does provide spacing. This team with Ish Smith in the starting lineup just lacks that spacing. He's a playmaker, but he can't space the floor whatsoever, so defenses can just collapse the paint. It's making life really, really difficult for the rest of the starting unit. So I think you need to really start looking at guys like a Tyreke Evans. He's on a one-year contract with Memphis right now. He's averaging 20 points per game. He can bring the ball up. He's not a traditional point guard, but he can play that role for you in the intermediate while Reggie Jackson rests. He's a guy that can really fill it up. He can space the floor. He can hit the three. I think you need to bring in a guy or a point guard. Maybe you do start to bundle up some of your assets. You look at Henry Ellenson. You look at a Stanley Johnson. You look at a future first-round pick. and salary filler to bring in a guy like Kemba Walker, because the Charlotte Hornets are going nowhere fast. So you really have to start, I think, swinging for the fences for one of these more premium-level players like a Kemba Walker, or bringing in a guy that's in a contract year to a bad team, maybe moving a future first-round pick, and some salary filler to bring in a guy that can fill an immediate need this season, and that might not be part of your long-term future.
David Fernandez joining us, talking Pistons basketball, talking trades, talking about ways to get this team out of what has just become an acceptance of average. And that's why I brought it up. And I'm not trying to tell Pistons fans how to feel, but it just, you know, they're average. They're average. And 4 years in, 3.5 years in now, they're supposed to be a lot better than average, pushing up toward the top teams in the East. Boston rose from below average to championship contender, at least conference championship contender, in the time that Stan Van Gundy's been in Detroit. Washington has done the same. Toronto has done the same. And the Pistons are just either below or at average, and I wonder when Pistons fans are going to say enough is enough. Average is not good enough. Jim Cushing, go ahead.
You know, and thinking about these trade kind of things, and also things I've been seeing on social media and whatnot, who exactly in any of these moves would the Pistons send away, and would Avery Bradley be out of Detroit a possibility here?
So some of the names that you're seeing is, in that Orlando deal, they were possibly looking to move Reggie Jackson and Luke Kennard, their promising rookie, which I think would just be a huge mistake. You're seeing other guys like John Lure possibly come up because he can make salary matches and also future assets, future first-round picks. I've heard Henry Ellenson's name dropped. One thing you just mentioned, Avery Bradley. I think that it's becoming time where at least people that I know that cover this team are really starting to question the long-term fit of Avery Bradley. He has been atrocious so far since he's been back from injury and really in his past like 20 games or so. So I don't think that he's the type of guy that this team should be looking to re-sign at the end of the year anyways at this point. So you might want to see what you can get from him from a contender that might just need a scrappy on-ball defender. I think that's a completely fair question, and I wouldn't be shocked whatsoever if Stan Van Gundy is shopping around Avery Bradley just to see what he might net. But the bad thing is Avery Bradley's stock has never been lower in his career than it is right now.
What happened? I mean, I know there's the personal issue, there's legal issues and those sorts of things, or accusations, allegations, whatever you want to call them. Is that what's weighing on him? Is it affecting his performance so much, or is there just a basketball reason why?
So there's a couple things. I think when you think about the X factors, yes, I think that has something to do with it. I think this is the first year, you know, Avery Bradley is now in a contract year. He's never been paid in the NBA yet. He's still on like a $5 or $6 million a year deal. He's looking to get paid at the end of this season, and he's not helping his chances whatsoever. On a basketball related sense, he was injured, but he doesn't look too bad, you know, right now when it comes, he's not laboring. He's not, you know, nursing anything. My whole thing is that the Pistons are relying on him so much right now. He's shooting around 14 or 15 shots per game. That's not what he should be doing. He should not be the main guy on your offensive unit. And he really is shooting more than, I believe, even Tobias Harris, who's a far better offensive product. Last year, what you saw in Boston, Isaiah Thomas was so, so good at collapsing defenses, at getting into the paint, at finding open shooters. He would have such better looks when Isaiah Thomas was the guy that was creating for him. Right now, he doesn't have that. He has to create for himself, and frankly, he's just not able to do it. And he's 27 years old, so he's not going to start building on his game and really start to, you know, all of a sudden just be able to destroy pick and rolls and create his own shot. I think that has a lot to do with it, that he's just being relied on too much, and he's a player that needs others to create for, and he can't create for himself.
David Fernandez joining us, talking about Pistons basketball and some of the problems plaguing them right now as they kind of muddle along. Injuries certainly a factor, especially to Reggie Jackson. No question about that. And what it might take to kind of get over the hump and become more competitive in the second half, particularly at the trading deadline. Real quick, David, the All-Star balloting, early returns are in, released just a few days ago. Are there any All-Stars that will be in this game from the Pistons? I got to assume that that Drummond would certainly be a consideration there. Anybody else?
No, I don't think so. Just looking at this team, Tobias Harris has had a solid year. But if you're going to be a guy that's averaging 18 points per game, 6 rebounds per game, and your team isn't 15 games over 500, or, you know, you're not on the Boston Celtics, you're not like an Al Horford type of player, I don't really think you belong in the game, to be honest. I think Andre Drummond is the only player this season on the Pistons that deserves to be up there. He's second in the league in rebounds. He's actually number one in defensive rating in the entire league. So he has really stepped up. He's the free throw problem for the most part, and has really just started to elevate his game. So I don't think that there is more than one all-star on this team. I don't think that there's a deserving another all-star on this team, honestly, right now.
Is that a testament to the lack of talent that Director of Basketball Ops Stan Van Gundy has been able to put on this roster, or is it a testament to the fact that Coach Van Gundy isn't getting a ton out of talented guys on this roster, that there are no all-stars after Andre Drummond?
I think that you look at this more so from a coach perspective. One of the guys that I think, you know, you might be able to say, I think, A, if you put Tobias Harris, you give it Tobias Harris more shots per game, you're going to look at better opportunities for the Pistons to win games, especially right now. There is no rhyme or reason why Avery Bradley should be shooting more than Tobias Harris, especially with Reggie Jackson being out. So I think if you, you know, had done that, and that's something that's been ingrained since the beginning of this season, then Tobias Harris might be averaging 20 points per game. Then you're really starting to have a more serious conversation of Tobias Harris being an all-star. We had the conversations like that earlier in the season when he was really kind of on fire. Since then, he's cooled down a bit. So I think that this is more so has to do with the coach, Stan Van Gundy, than the GM, just because you look at some of the moves that he's done to get some of these guys in there. The Tobias Harris trade was a fleecing from Orlando. They traded Brandon Jennings and I want to say Ersan Ilyasova for Tobias Harris.
That sounds right.
And Brandon Jennings is not in the league this morning, and Ersan Ilyasova has been traded five times on that same contract. So I think he has done a good job in a lot of the trades that he's made, but it's just something where he hasn't gotten the most out of his guys, and you can really start to look at, you know, guys like Stanley Johnson, Luke Kennard, who's not playing enough, in my opinion, as some other evidence to say that Stan Van Gundy hasn't gotten the most out of his guys.
For the just the sake of information, Andre Drummond is eighth in the front court voting in the Eastern Conference, behind Antetokounmpo, James Embiid, Porzingis, Kevin Love, Al Horford, and Jason Tatum. Then we get to Andre Drummond at number eight, and there are no guards, no backcourt guys listed among the top 10 in the Eastern Conference from the Pistons. So everything you said is probably spot on. David Fernandez, writing for DetroitBadBoys.com, keeping his finger on the pulse of the Pistons as we push up toward All-Star time and as we push up toward trade deadlines and trying to find if this team can rise itself above mediocrity and the ho-hum blasé franchise that, quite frankly, they've become under Stan Van now 3.5 years in. David, great stuff, good analysis. We'll catch up with you again real soon.
All right, hopefully better times ahead.
Yeah, hopefully, because it would be a hell of a lot more fun talking about, you know, a great big winning streak and pushing up toward the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference and then just muddling along, or middling along, I guess, the way that they are. But hopefully that will be coming. Thank you, David.
Take care.
The voting, for those who do not know, it's not just the fan vote, obviously. I was just giving you Andre Drummond, eighth spot in the front court in the Eastern Conference, and I just want to read it to you directly from the NBA. For the second consecutive year, NBA players and basketball media will join fans in selecting the All-Star Game starters. Fans will account for 50% of the vote, while all current players and a media panel will account for 25% each. Personally, I think they're giving the fans too much. Kush, just here's an example. Out in the West, the fan vote has, in the Western Conference, guards,
okay,
Steph Curry, number one, no problem.
Okay.
James Harden, number two, no problem.
Yeah.
Russell Westbrook, number three, no problem.
Okay.
Klay Thompson, number four, no problem.
Yeah.
Manu Ginobili,
yeah,
at this age, probably not, but okay. Chris Paul, number six, should be higher.
Yeah.
Damian Lillard, number seven, probably about where he should be.
Yeah.
Number eight is Lonzo Ball, ahead of Devin Booker of Phoenix and Jimmy Butler of the Timberwolves. Lonzo Ball shouldn't be eighth.
That's ridiculous.
He shouldn't be eighth on the Lakers in terms of number of All-Star votes that he is getting. And he is the leading vote getter for the Lakers, which just doesn't make any sense at all. No, I take that back. Take that back. Kyle Kuzma, his fellow rookie, the 27th overall pick. He's number 9 in the front court. He's got 184,000. That's more than Lonzo Ball's 120,000. So he is second on the Lakers in terms of votes. But point is, he's ahead of guys like Devin Booker and Jimmy Butler, who are both star players in this league and in the Western Conference.
And the being ahead of Jimmy Butler thing is bordering on a crime.
Yeah,
I mean,
no question.
He is doing the same Jimmy Butler things he was in Chicago, and he's the veteran you bring in when the kids are ready, and that's why Minnesota's, you know, decent and going to make the playoffs probably for the first time in, what would it be, 14 years?
Yeah, Jimmy Butler's averaging 21.5 points, 5.1 rebounds, 5.4 assists. Timberwolves teams, that's a team that's first in the Northwest.
Yep.
They're 26-16, yep. A 3-game bulge over Portland. It's impossible.
Yeah, that's the part of everything you just laid out with the Lonzo Ball part. That's the one that upsets me more than anything else. In no universe should he be ahead of Jimmy Butler. That's just wrong.
And I don't know why you're glossing over the Devin Booker part of this. Devin Booker, now, admittedly, Phoenix is terrible, but so are the Lakers, right? Phoenix is 16-26. They're still better than the Lakers, by the way.
Right. Lakers are worst in the West.
What's that?
Lakers are worst in the West right now.
That's right. They are. Lakers are 13-27. Phoenix is 16-26. They might say, oh, it's bad. But Devin Booker is averaging 24.9 points and four assists and 4.5 rebounds. Devin Booker plays circles around Lonzo Ball. And Lonzo Ball has said, anyway, my point to that is what the fans shouldn't get to vote. L.A. is L.A., and even though they suck, the Staples Center is still filled, and there's still a lot of people going online and doing their voting for their Lakers.
Of course.
And Phoenix isn't going to get that, and Minnesota isn't going to get that.
Right.
And that's why I'm glad that the NBA is doing a bit of a, you know, split in terms of percentages, but I just don't like the percentage. Players vote counts for 25% each. Media, 25%. Media panel accounts for 25%. Fans for 50%. They get too much credit. They just do, because that's ridiculous.
It's still an improvement on what it is before, and baseball should take note.
Yes, indeed. They should. But anybody who grabs a ballot or gets their smartphone out and starts tapping, did you know that you can vote on Amazon Alexa? You can do on the Amazon Echo. I didn't know this. I mean, you actually do. You just here's all the different ways that you can vote, according to the NBA website, NBA.com. You can vote on their webpage at NBA.com. You can vote via the NBA app. You can vote via Facebook. You can vote via Twitter. You can vote via Google search. You can vote via Amazon Alexa. Just say Alexa, open NBA All-Star, and you can request votes for each of the players that you choose. And then there's, I don't know if you know what Sina Weibo is. It looks like it's some foreign thing. Anyway, the rest of that story here. Players and media will be able to complete one full ballot featuring 3 front court players and 2 guards, each from the Eastern and Western Conferences. After all votes are tallied, players will then be ranked in each conference by position, guard or front court. Within each of the 3 voting groups, fan votes, player votes, and media votes, each player's score will be calculated by averaging his weighted rank from the fan votes, the player votes, and the media votes. The 5 players, 2 guards, and 3 front court players with the best score in each conference will be named the starters. Fan voting will serve as a tiebreaker for players in position groups with the same score. And then we get into the selection of the teams. I don't know exactly. This part isn't listed here. I wish it was, because I want to talk more at some point. Anyway, it doesn't have to be right now, about the leading vote getter in each conference being able to pick his team, kind of like old captain style, like you used to do on the playground. Kush, I'm sure you were always the first pick in your playground battles, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Poor Goose. Will somebody please take Jimmy? He's over in the corner feeling awfully bad. Okay. We thought he was going to cheer. We thought he was cheering. No, I'm teasing. Anyway, that part of this is very interesting to see how they pull that off with the captains, if you will, picking the All-Stars and filling out the rosters that way. So you can potentially have teammate against teammate. You could potentially have LeBron James against Kevin Love or Steph Curry against Klay Thompson, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of interesting about that. All right, let me get a quick timeout. Bottom of the hour, local sports center. Come back. Final segment coming up. Want to get you involved, too, at 866-240-1065 on the ticket. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, buddy, rolling along. It's 4:43. I count 17 minutes of outstanding also left for you on this afternoon's extravaganza. Coming up at 5 o'clock, it'll be drive time with Mr. Miller right here on the ticket. So going back, what the hell, Kush? We've spent the entire day above the state line. We have not talked about anything about the Browns-Green Bay imports. Elliot Wolf, who is the son of Ron Wolf and longtime Packers assistant in a variety of capacities in the front office, worked very, very closely with John Dorsey, the new GM for the Browns. He has been hired and brought in, as has another Packers executive, front office executive, former Miami superstar Alonzo Highsmith. I always loved Alonzo Highsmith, great runner. They are all coming on board in Cleveland, so a really interesting, you know, assemblance of talent in the front office there with Dorsey, Highsmith, and Elliot Wolf.
Big Whoop, get back to me when they actually draft successfully.
I totally agree. That's one of the reasons I'm not spending a ton of time on this now. But I will say, from, you know, Browns fans' perspectives, who just held an 0-16 parade, and who are still trying to figure out why in the hell their head coach has been retained after a 1-31 two-year span, this is, let's put it to you this way, Jim, this is the post-draft moment for them. Not on players, but on front office. They're looking at it and saying, wow, we hit on our first round pick for a change. This is a guy who's got, you know, he's got some cachet, John Dorsey does. He has built a program. He has built a couple of different franchises in terms of stocking them with talent. You know, he's the guy in Kansas City who drafted Kareem Hunt, for example, you know, yeah, out of Toledo. He has put some things together before. And so for the Browns fans, as bad as things have been, you know how it's after they see who the first, you said to yourself, so you get back to me after the draft and we'll see. Well, right now it's, you know, it's the front office draft. It's the Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta did not work. Excuse me. Brown is gone. DePodesta is still there. But essentially, it's a rebuild in the front office. And so it's, we got to go draft new guys. And if you look at it from a who is established and has done this before rather than newbies who have never even sniffed it, such as the lawyer Sashi Brown and the baseball scout Paul DePodesta, this feels like a post-draft home run. It's like we're grading our draft, and, hey, we got the best quarterback in the draft, we got the best offensive lineman in the draft, and we got maybe the best pass rusher in the draft. Right now, the Browns fans have to be feeling like, man, we got the top-rated general manager, we got one of the, you know, top-rated assistant general managers, if that's what title they end up giving Elliot Wolf, and an extremely very well-respected young executive in Alonzo Highsmith. Browns fans have got to be feeling like this is draft. This is post-draft moment right now. They drafted for the front office, and there might be a reason to believe that they can do better.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of hopefully take my position, wait and see. But, you know, the door is open, and they have all the draft picks. They have the ton of money that they could spend on various free agents, and any they pick up they'd have to, you know, overpay for, because, you know, it's the Browns, and who wants to play for the Browns? And so all the potential's there for this regime to finally, you know, turn some things around. But, you know, pardon me if I'm just not excited about it, because I've seen this. We've been exactly in this position at least four times in the last 8 to 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've seen this movie many, many times, and it sucks every time we see it. Have you ever watched a really, really bad movie? This is why they had the parade.
Yeah.
This is why they had the parade. I don't know that I've ever in my life gone to a movie theater and forked out, I don't know, what's an average movie these days, around 10, 11 bucks a seat?
Yeah, 14 in the prime showings in the evening, something like that.
I don't know that I've ever paid that kind of money to watch a movie. Walked out of it saying, oh my God, that was awful. That it was supposed to be a comedy, it didn't make me laugh. It was supposed to be a thriller, it didn't thrill me. It was supposed to be a drama, it wasn't dramatic, acting was terrible. That piece of crap. I've never walked out of a movie saying those things and then the next week gone back and bought tickets to the same gosh dang movie. I've never done it.
Right.
I've never done it, and I never will do it, and I sure as hell, if I accidentally do stumble into the wrong theater and see the same piece of crap again, I'm going to make damn sure I did not do it again the third week. And that's what the Browns fans have been through. They've watched the crappiest movie in the history of cinema and then bought new tickets to go watch it again the next week. and then new tickets to go watch it again the next week, and on down the line. And some of them buy season tickets so they can watch the movie in a continuing run in their favorite theater and watch it suck every single time. I'm not that guy, so I'm with you, Jim. We have seen this movie, and I have no reason to believe it's going to get better this time around. None. Having said that, coming off of 131, 1 in 31, all you can do is hope that the cast of characters that led to this terrible movie, changing, new actors, new director, might give me a better plot line, might give me a better outcome at the end of the movie. That's the difference. That's all I'm saying. They're changing the actors, they're changing the director, mm-hmm. maybe even the producer, and hopefully the movie gets better. And as long as we're on that front, just to very briefly mention it, because I said that we stayed above the top, above north of the state line, and I want to do it again. But just real quick, Houston Texans quarterback coach Sean Ryan was out there in Cleveland today, and he was interviewing for the Browns coordinator job. We all know that Hugh Jackson does not want to have a coordinator.
Right.
He is his own coordinator. This is being forced upon him by Jimmy Haslam as part of the condition of keeping him around for a third year. I don't know how this will work. I am encouraged by the fact that they are giving Jackson the autonomy to hire his own coordinator in this circumstance. The one thing you don't want to do, in my opinion, is bring back a coach who's terrible, who's been 1-31, who is his own offensive coordinator, and say, we're going to bring you back because we trust you, but we don't trust you enough to call the plays anymore. We're going to hire an offensive coordinator for you. For it to work, Jackson has to like the guy. For it to work, Jackson has to have a comparable, if not identical, but a comparable philosophy on offensive football for this coordinator to work with this head coach who is so offensively engaged. So I'm glad that Hugh Jackson is able to choose who he wants to interview and then choose eventually who he wants to hire. That is a good thing. But what's bad about all of this, in addition to all of the obvious things, is that the hierarchy is still so screwed up. The organization, for example, Hugh Jackson being retained as head coach is still reporting to Jimmy Haslam. Paul DePodesta, who's kept on as analytics dude without much, because I don't think John Dorsey is going to be going to Paul DePodesta and saying, what's your computer printout say about this pick? Because here's who I like. What is the computer like? I think DePodesta is being kept around for the same reason that Hugh Jackson is being kept around, because Jimmy Haslam is afraid to say that my entire idea 2 years ago sucked. It blew up in my face. I hired Jackson, Brown, Sashi Brown, that is, and DePodesta, and they all suck. So even though it's true that they all suck, particularly Hugh Jackson at 131, he fired one of the three in Sashi Brown, but he's keeping the other two around because he just can't make himself admit that I screwed up royally. And that's why DePodesta's around. But the point is, DePodesta answers to Haslam, not to John Dorsey. John Dorsey answers to Haslam. And then Hugh Jackson answers to Haslam. It's like everybody answers to the owner who's meddling and engaged in football decisions rather than just being the financier of this thing, hiring the right people and getting the living hell out of the way. Let Hugh Jackson report to his new boss, John Dorsey. Let John Dorsey report if there's going to be a club president to a club president, and let that president report to Jimmy Haslam. But the fact that all of these different people, player personnel guys reporting to the owner, coaches reporting to the owner, so the owner's got to sit there and listen to the he said, the power struggle between Sashi Brown and Hugh Jackson. Now will there be a power struggle of any kind between Hugh Jackson, his handpicked offensive coordinator, and which might have their own ideas about who's to be drafted and pursued in free agency, and the Green Bay guys. The Green Bay guys, which is kind of what they're going to be known as, I would imagine, because that's what they are, Highsmith and, Dorsey Highsmith and Elliott Wolf. Power struggles where nobody is in a position of authority over anybody else. They all just report to Jimmy Haslam, and he's the only authority figure in the room, and to Aaron, the organization. And to me, that is just a recipe for disaster. So, Jim, I'm with you. Well, I'm glad to see the movie changing its cast, getting new actors involved, getting new directors. We have no reason to believe the movie will be better this time around, and especially when you consider what I just pointed out as being a mitigating circumstance here. They might have the best actors in the world, but they still have the worst freaking studio owner ever and Jimmy Haslam, who is going to allow them to muck this entire thing up. That's a rant I didn't expect to give. Didn't really want to do it. I wanted to spend the last segment, I'll spend the last 2 minutes of it now, on a similar story, though, and that is the Lions organization. Much more stable in that Bob Quinn is the general manager who is going to be engaged in this hiring process to find a replacement for Jim Caldwell. But, Kush, it was reported earlier today that Patriots defensive coordinator Matt Patricia, who is a big-time prospect on a lot of teams that are looking for coaches, he's on their short list. Matt Patricia has decided that, given a choice between the New York Giants and the Detroit Lions and their coaching vacancies, if and when he's able to interview after the season ends for the Patriots, he would prefer to go to New York. Is that a bit of a slap? Is that a bit of a slap in the face at the city? Is it a slap in the face at Bob Quinn, who knows Patricia from his time in New England? Is it a slap in the face at the Ford family, or is it just, maybe he just likes New York better? But all I know is it makes the Detroit Lions coaching search look that much more desperate.
Yeah, that last part is absolutely true, and it's a bad, unfortunate piece of news for the Lions and their fans, who ever since Caldwell was fired, a little over a week ago at this point, the assumption was, yeah, they're going to interview a bunch of guys, but hold out and wait for Matt Patricia, because he's probably going to be the guy. The fact that this news came out, and I'm not sure which to interpret it. I honestly don't know which one it is, that he would just prefer a New York, that it's some kind of slap in the face to Detroit or an old colleague of his from New England and Quinn. I'm not honestly sure which one it is. All I do know is it's bad news for the Lions.
Yeah, it really is, and it's disappointing news. You would like to think that Caldwell built the franchise up enough, with Quinn's help, of course, in the last 2 years, that Caldwell, rescued it from the doldrums that it was in when he was hired 4 years ago to a point of respectability now. I think the Lions are a respectable club at 9-7, missed the playoffs. They're not great, but they're respectable. That it would be an attractive enough place to pull top coaching candidates and to make them want to be there. To me, the Giants situation looks more of a train wreck than the Lions does right now. But maybe it's the city of New York and the draw of the big city. Maybe that's where a guy like Patricia wants to know. But you would hope that Bob Quinn would have a little bit more pull with Patriots coaches,
right,
and people that he has, that he has worked with before. And maybe it's a blessing in disguise. Maybe Josh McDaniels, who is still also expected to be a head coach at some point shortly after the Patriots season ends, whether it's after the Super Bowl or whatever playoff loss happens, maybe Josh McDaniels will be a guy. I don't know, but I just know that Matt Patricia, when asked, Detroit or New York, said New York, and that's got to be a tough thing for Lions fans, because he is really, truly, And by the way, I should point out the obvious. It's not like either one of those guys is guaranteed to be the right guy.
Right.
Because Bill Belichick's coaching tree is not an impressive one.
Right.
If you look at the number of coaches that have left Belichick's staff and gone on elsewhere, it's not filled with a bunch of success stories. Charlie Weiss comes to mind, McDaniel's first run in Denver, in which he got fired, comes to mind. So it's not like, hey, because you come from Belichick, you are Belichick. That's not that's something we have to keep in mind, too. Okay, we'll keep that in mind for tomorrow, though. Unless you want to keep it in mind now and you're going to hear Mike Miller talk about it, I don't know. That's up to Mike. Drive Time is coming up next. Thanks for being with us this afternoon on the Extravaganza. We'll see you tomorrow.